So thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. And what I thought I would do today is talk about causation and the temporal arrow, but from the perspective of someone who's very interested in causal and temporal experience. So I'm going to try to mix some issues involving the philosophy of mind and cognitive science with fundamental metaphysics. Standard physics and the metaphysics which follows its lead does not give an account of how we experience C causing E, that is, of how we experience the way C makes E occur, or our experience of how C brings E about. Physics and many of the metaphysics that engages with the science also leaves out temporal experience. Okay, so for example, what it's like for us to experience temporal duration, our experience of time's passing, of things happening, of the sense of presentness or existing now, or of the inaccessibility of other times from whatever time we happen to be at. Moreover, time in particular is special. Its specialness consists in the fact that, unlike with many other features of the world, including particular spatial locations, we can't separate ourselves from time when we contemplate it. Okay, so we're sort of necessarily embedded within time, even as we try to consider it as metaphysicians. It's partly because we can't separate ourselves from time that we need to address its ontology from the inside. That is, we need to look at temporal experience just as much as we need to look at the metaphysics of time from the outside. And because the science and a lot of the metaphysics that follows its lead doesn't focus on causal or temporal experience, then we can see that physics and this kind of metaphysics doesn't explain the nature of our experience of change or our experience as of being able to control the future and how that difference features in our experience of the world as causal agents. Now, I take time and causation to be metaphysically and physically interrelated. Okay. In fact, I also am inclined to think that that time is in some sense more fundamental, metaphysically speaking, than causal relations are. I also take causal experience and temporal experience to be fundamentally interrelated, although the relationship here may be a kind of fundamental cognitive interrelation. And that's because I think we experience the direction in particular of causation as intimately bound up with the direction of time. And we experience time's passing in tandem with events causing other events to change. So much so that many have thought that the passage of time could not be observed without observing qualitative change. So if we existed in a place that had no qualitative change, we might not be able to actually detect the passage of time, okay, even though qualitative change and pure passage are conceptually and metaphysically distinct, or so I would argue. And any experience as of a lawfully evolving universe, in other words, where we have sort of world stage after world stage after world stage evolving in a lawful, productive way, right, involves experiences as of the causal movement of things happening over time, with causal generation from earlier to later as events produce successive events. Okay, so what I want to do here is explore at least, the way that two main theories of the temporal direction, time's arrow, and their related views about the metaphysics of causation, I think, need to engage more with our temporal experience and causal experience to have a kind of complete picture of what we're arguing for when we're arguing for different theories of the temporal arrow and the causal arrow. I think we need to include an assessment of what we learn from our temporal and causal experience. Now, to argue for this, I need to do some methodological scene setting. Because you can't really understand, I think, the relationship between experience and fundamental metaphysics without having a grasp on what the methodological perspective is that you're taking when you're trying to do this sort of metaphysics. Now, much of English-speaking philosophy, anyway, in the 20th century, including metaphysics, focused on conceptual analysis. That is, on attempting to analyze and explicate a range of philosophically interesting concepts. So the thought was that what we're trying to do is understand various kinds of concepts we might have about suitably universal and fundamental categories, right? So the concept of cause, for example, was analyzed, especially in the 20th century, variously as sufficiency under the laws of nature, as counterfactual dependence, and then as analyses of counterfactual dependence got developed as more complicated analyses of counterfactual dependence. And then there were related ways of explicating their concept of causation that sort of joined elements of those particular views together, a number of different things. But all of the focus was on understanding what our concept of causation was. And the thought being that we needed to kind of explicate what that concept meant so that if we moved to some possible world, if we thought that there was causation in that world, that that concept would apply there. What contemporary metaphysics is interested in nowadays, I think, is really quite different. While contemporary metaphysicians surely use concepts in the formation of their theories, and we still care to a certain extent about conceptual analysis, we're not officially, I think, just restricted to conceptual analysis anymore. And often, the work isn't even about concepts per se at all. Instead, a lot of the contemporary metaphysics is focused on giving an account of the nature and the existence of entities in the world directly. So for example, when we're talking about causation, the focus when we're doing causation is not on the concept of causation, explicating the concept of causation, but rather on giving a theory of what the causal relation is, or of what it might reduce to fundamentally. So such a theory might hold that causal relations are, or in other words, reduced to, transfers of conserved physical quantities like force or momentum, relations of counterfactual dependence, or maybe they're just instances of a prescribed sort of making happened as governed by the laws. So instead of analyzing a concept of causation as involving concepts of, let's say, counterfactual dependence, instead we say something like, well, we're going to tell you what the causal relation is. And here it is. It's a certain kind of defined or prescribed counterfactual dependence. So that's an important switch there from our concepts to the nature of the world, sort of full stop. Now, how are we supposed to be able to do this? Well, very roughly, the thought is that contemporary metaphysics starts with the manifest image, okay, the world as it appears to us, as the basis for an account of whatever part of reality we're interested in exploring. Okay? And then we take that manifest image, or the part of that manifest image that we're interested in, and we refine it based on what we know empirically about the world. Now, of course, we draw conclusions defeasibly, knowing that we might be making mistakes, but this kind of defeasible inference, I think, is a very natural and standard one to make, especially if we're doing it in light of our most sophisticated natural science. In other words, the very natural connection that many metaphysicians make here when performing this project is a connection between physics and other natural sciences and metaphysical inquiry. So in particular, if we're making claims about the fundamental nature of reality, metaphysicians realize, I think to a larger and larger extent, that we need to know about what our best physics is saying about fundamental physical reality. Okay, so I think so far, this should be standard and shouldn't be surprising to anybody, although I think often these things are not said maybe as clearly as they need to be said. But what I want to sort of bring out today, and I'm going to use causation and time as a kind of case study, is I think there's a new direction that we need to go in when exploring the connections, the appropriate connections between empirical refinement and metaphysics, given that we want to refine our manifest image. For simply focusing on physics and related natural science as the empirical corrective to theories of fundamental reality leaves out something crucial. It leaves out what we know from the psychological sciences. Because remember, we're focusing on the manifest image, we're focusing on how we experience the world. Right? Physics informs and constrains metaphysical claims about fundamental reality. But cognitive science, on the other hand, informs and constrains metaphysical claims about our experience, and by extension, about how we draw our intuitions from experience, and which intuitions we should be relying on, and how we should be relying on them. If we're going to start with the manifest image, to be sure, we need to compare that to what we know about the unobservable structure of fundamental physical reality, and use what we know from physics and other natural sciences about the unobserved realm to refine or correct the account of causation, or time, or objects, or properties, etc. But we must also know how the features of the manifest image are cognitively generated. First, because this can teach us how to interpret and understand the features of our experience. And second, because it can teach us how to detect and understand features of our experience that are mere byproducts or spandrels of cognitive processing. I think this becomes especially clear when we see how in metaphysics, when the physics runs out, a central place is reserved for quasi-perceptual or intuition, or quasi-perceptual judgments or intuitive judgments, drawn from our ordinary experience of the world. Such intuitions play a central role when we claim that a metaphysical theory helps to provide an explanation of a certain kind of experience, or that experience gives us evidence in some sense for a view. So if we discover that certain features of our experience are mere cognitive byproducts or spandrels, this undercuts the evidential status of these features of our experience. So the thought here is that just as we know we need to pay attention to physics when we're doing metaphysics, it's a less familiar claim, but I think just as it's something that we should grant, just as much as we grant that there's a role for physics when we're doing metaphysics, we should grant that there's a role for cognitive science as well. It's a little bit different how we understand that role, but I think it's equally important, even if it's a less familiar claim to take, position to take. Now, let me try to say a little bit more about what's going on here, because I think understanding the relationship that cognitive science has to metaphysics can, I think, be complex and involves a kind of deep cognitive issue. The suggestion is not that we simply look to psychology, find evidence that our experience of the world is psychologically constructed, and then simply dismiss metaphysical intuitions or a metaphysical theory of the world as the product of some sort of psychological or cognitive bias. I think that's too quick and way too cheap. The suggestion is not that, reasoning from the possibility that the manifest image is psychologically constructed, that we should just adopt a pragmatic stance towards the metaphysics. That's also far too quick. I think matters here are much more subtle. So what I'm going to talk a little bit about is how much of the character of our experiences, and in particular causal and temporal experiences, derives from the way that we process visual and other sensory information about the world. As a result, even if we are veridically perceiving when we experience causal and temporal features, our judgment of their character and intuitive importance may be affected by contingent features of our cognitive processing and representation. This means it's important for us to acknowledge some of the deep connections between our cognitive response to the world, as discovered and developed by empirical work in psychology and cognitive science, and our theorizing about the intrinsic nature of reality. And I should note and emphasize here that I'm adopting a resolutely sort of scientific realism here, and I'm not defending a kind of Kantian perspective, although there is a kind of Kantian element to contemporary psychology and cognitive science. It's not any kind of Kantian element that we have to worry about if we're realists. So I think that these connections need to be explored and ideally used to enrich and motivate a developed metaphysical theory of the intrinsic structure of reality, one that can fit an account of the nature of the fundamental metaphysical features of the world, and to fit that with our cognitive response to the world. So the point is that we don't use empirical work in cognitive science to replace metaphysical theories about causal and temporal reality. That's not the view that I'm developing here. Instead, we take a more sophisticated approach to our way of understanding metaphysical explanations and evidence that blends considerations drawn from the manifest image with a scientifically realist interpretation of empirical research, an approach informed by cognitive science as well as by physics. So now, what I want to do is look at this issue more closely in the context of understanding how to think about causal judgments that are related to the metaphysics of time's arrow. This is both a case study as well as a discussion of a particular topic. I think it's very helpful when one makes these methodological claims to see just how you need to do, how to do it sort of in a particular example. There's a central metaphysical dispute over the nature of the temporal arrow and its cousin, causation, between the anti-reductionist or primitivist about temporal direction and causation, and the fan of a much more minimal view, often a kind of neo-Humean supervenience view, but who I'll just think of as the minimalist, because I mean to cover a range of different ontologically minimal views here. Now, this is a debate over what fundamental ontology is needed for the temporal, causal, and lawful asymmetry of the universe, exhibited by the way that the universe evolves forward in a direction. The idea is that the universe seems to exhibit a directive, productive capacity from moment to moment, moving from the present into the future. This temporal asymmetry underlies, or is the same as, the asymmetrical fact that the past is fixed while the future is open. I'm just going to assume that. As well as the asymmetry of counterfactual dependence and the causal relation. The issue is also deeply related to the idea that there are productive laws of nature that drive the universe forward. The anti-reductionist takes time's arrow to be a fundamental temporal tendency of the universe to evolve forward and successively create world stage from world stage, one stage causally producing the next, by generating it via the action of productive laws of nature. The thought is also that we take this notion of the world's causally evolving as a thick or substantive notion, where successive world stages are created or produced in some kind of oomphy biff-like sense by prior stages. So the forward evolution of reality, or of the world, or however you want to describe it, involves a kind of primitively dynamic generation or production, a primitive asymmetry of reality, where successive stages come into the existence, to come into existence as the result of being caused by prior stages, guided by the fundamental physical laws. Think of the picture as this: the arrow plus the laws drive reality forward, giving us the directive, productive, causal evolution of the world. The minimalist denies this. She thinks that there's no need for any added in primitive arrow or some kind of thick causal production. Instead, time's arrow is reducible to global entropic asymmetries and a few related facts, at least on one minimalist picture. And causation is largely a matter of counterfactual dependence. On this view, the counterfactual, temporal, and causal asymmetries are grounded by a fundamental asymmetry in entropy, described by the second law of thermodynamics. The idea is that the temporal asymmetry is grounded by minimalist facts that embody the fundamental physical laws, plus the fact that the initial macro state of the universe is very low entropy, plus maybe some facts about probability distributions. I won't give you any more detail, you don't really need it. According to the minimalist, once we have the atemporal basic facts, there's no further ontological need for a fundamental, primitively directed temporal arrow. The minimalist, then, wields Occam's razor to argue in favor of a simpler, more minimal ontological base. This is not a debate over the physics, okay? All parties agree on the physics, and all agree that reality includes some kind of global entropic asymmetry. The dispute is really about the fundamental metaphysics. Sometimes it's a dispute about what we need to include in our metaphysics of fundamental reality. Sometimes it's a dispute about which arrows and asymmetries actually, metaphysically speaking, really exist, given that we have the global entropic asymmetry. Now, an important anti-reductionist response to the more minimalist fan of Occam's razor is that basically the claim is that the minimalist, even though the minimalist has, you know, they agree on their physics, the minimalist can't actually explain things of substance. In other words, the minimalist can't make sense of the way that we really seem to understand our world. The complaint is that minimalists, for example, when they regard the laws, take them to be mere regularities. They take causation sometimes to be mere counterfactual dependence. These kinds of pictures don't explain why we seem to experience the world as involving one thing being generated from another thing in a lawful, oomphy, and productive way. In other words, the minimalist can't explain our sense of the world as being lawfully guided and causally productive. With regard to the temporal arrow, the complaint is that just saying that entropy or disorder increases towards the future doesn't capture what we experience as the temporally directed productive oomph of the universe. It just doesn't explain our experience of the world as directed happening. So the thought is that because there's no kind of intuitive connection between this austere metaphysical picture provided by the minimalist and our ordinary experience or our way of understanding the world as a kind of generative, productive evolution, we can't understand the manifest image with the minimalist tools that we've been given. On the other hand, the anti-reductionist picture is thought to explain a central aspect of our basic picture of the world. Time seems to pass. The world seems to dynamically evolve forward, and things seem to change in just the way the anti-reductionist says they do. Why? Well, because those are features of our fundamental metaphysical ontology, and so that's what underlies our very natural picture and understanding of the world. We observe oomphy series of things like billiard balls hitting other billiard balls, streams of events such as a row of dominoes falling over, each hitting the next one in sequence, and generally of one event following another in a causally productive, temporally directed way. So it seems like, at least according to the anti-reductionist stance, that the minimalist lacks any adequate explanation, apart from a simple error theory and an adherence to Occam, for our basic experience of the world being how it is in the manifest image. So you can summarize the anti-reductionist argument this way. The thought is, look, we have experiences as of the causally productive, lawfully directed evolution of reality. The anti-reductionist thesis, and so I grant that we have these experiences, everyone grants that we have these experiences. The anti-reductionist says, look, causally productive, lawfully directed evolution is a primitive, fundamental feature of reality. This provides, says the anti-reductionist, the only substantive, non-ad hoc explanation of these experiences. A simple error theory is just utterly unconvincing. If the anti-reductionist is right, if, in other words, he's able to produce really the only substantive explanation of these experiences, well, then it seems as though the anti-reductionist has produced the best explanation of these experiences. So obviously the only thing I changed was from only was to best, because if there's only one candidate, it's got to be the best candidate. All right. And then the thought is, using inference to the best explanation, that if the anti-reductionist is giving us the best explanation of the way that we experience the world as a causally productive, lawfully directed evolution, well then, using inference to the best explanation, we should endorse the anti-reductionist view. If the minimalist doesn't have any substantive explanation of our experience of the directed, causally productive nature of the universe, well, the anti-reductionist is right. He's given the best explanation because it's the only explanation of how we should understand reality. So the dialectic settles then in the following way. The minimalist has Occam and simplicity on her side. The anti-reductionist has explanatory power. The dispute becomes one in which we have to choose. We choose between a metaphysical theory with a minimal ontology and a correspondingly minimal explanatory stance, and a metaphysical theory with an inflated ontology and a correspondingly powerful explanatory stance. Now, if you're a fan of Occam, as I tend to be, I think we shouldn't let things rest here. In other words, I think that the minimalist could do a much better job of showing how she could provide a satisfying error theoretic explanation of our experience of reality in order to be convincing. And the way to do this, I think, is to better understand the way our cognitive system might be constructing perceptions of things like lawful guidance, direction, and our sense of causal productivity. Because I think then she can use this to offer a competing, minimalist-friendly explanation of the relevant features of our experience, one that can be used to undercut the anti-reductionist view. So what we're doing is constructing an account that's going to undercut the anti-reductionist explanation by undercutting the anti-reductionist experiential base. I won't go through all of it here, but I'm going to give you now an account of how this, I think, should work. So I think the neo-Humean, or minimalist, can start by drawing on Michaud's launching cases. These cases, Albert Michaud was a Belgian psychologist, an experimental psychologist who was very brilliant, working in the 40s and 50s, very interesting thinker, and I think in the last 20 years has really experienced a renaissance in contemporary vision science and experimental psychology. The cases that I'm interested in, launching cases, bring out features of the way we experience the world as causally generative. Launching cases are cases involving a special sort of perception of causation. Okay, even though, of course, we don't visually detect a causal relation, that's an assumption that we're going to just rely on. In such cases, launching cases, we have a strong perceptual experience as of detecting that causation has occurred. Classic versions of such cases describe things like a cue ball hitting an eight ball and knocking it into a corner pocket. In this case, you'll see the red ball hit the blue ball. Now, what Michaud discovered was that events arranged in the right spatiotemporal manner create a perception as of causation. The sense that one event, the red ball making contact with the blue ball, is causally launching another event. The blue ball is moving away. There are four features of Michaud's intensely interesting discovery that are relevant for what I want to talk about here. So first, at some point I'll turn this off because it will get distracting, but first, we have these perceptual experiences when the right spatiotemporal arrangements exist, entirely independently of whether the perception is veridical. That is, in some cases with these features, there may be causation, but in some cases with these features, there may not. We'll have the causal impression all the same. Thus, the description of the experience as a causal perception is not necessarily a description of a veridical perception. Mere spatiotemporal juxtaposition is enough. The second important feature for our purposes is that these causal impressions are modular. That is, such perceptions are fast, automatic, and relatively immune to revision, even when we update our beliefs. I want to say a little bit more about this in a related tag. In the Mueller-Lyer illusion, for example, the perceptual illusion is modular in the sense that even after, so you have the experience right away that the shorter line, the line below looks shorter and the line above looks longer, although they're the same length. Even after you measure the lines, if you could sit there on a piece of and look at the illusion on a piece of paper and measure the lines and discover for yourself that they're of equal length, you'll still experience the illusion. So it's not like a sort of optical illusion, like when you're driving and you see water seeming to shimmer on the road in front of you, but then you get closer and that disappears. Now, recognizing a modular perceptual illusion can be especially difficult when illusory parts are embedded in an experience that also has non-illusory parts. In the Mueller-Lyer illusion, the illusory part of the experience is easy to pick out. Once you know the lines are the same length, it's your experience that the lower of the two lines seems to be shorter than the upper one that's illusory. But there's much about this manifest feature of this drawing that's not illusory. Non-illusory parts of your experience include the experience as of seeing two lines, two horizontal lines, seeing one line above the other, seeing lines with opposite facing arrowheads, and etc. None of that is an illusion. Okay. Michaud's causal launching effect is similar in that it's modular, so you can know that you're not seeing causation, yet it'll still seem to you as though it's a normal, non-illusory part of ordinary causal experience. And in fact, these kinds of illusions happen all around us. The complication with the Michaud case is that it's often correlated in the physical world with actual causation and embedded in non-illusory contexts. Okay, so it's modular in the sense that if you had an experimenter with two flashlights and you sort of if you had two laser pointers and I had one dot here and held it steady and then moved another one along just the way that you saw the red ball and the blue ball move, you could have an experience as of launching if I then move the second dot off. It would seem as though the first dot caused the second one to move, even though you know the first dot isn't causing the second one to move. I'm the one who's doing all the causing. You can see me. There's no curtain. You can see me doing what I'm doing. But you'll still have the launching effect. That's what modularity sort of brings out. Now, this fact actually gets exploited. There we go. This fact gets exploited in video games like this, okay? In other words, this fact, the modularity of this effect, is what's exploited by virtual reality effects, video imaging. All kinds of computer effects basically are built out of understanding how we impose causal structure on juxtaposed images. Now, what makes the launching effect tricky is that unless you know that the illusion is there, you won't notice it as an illusion, unless, of course, you're Albert Michaud or similarly brilliant experimental psychologist, right? And as I was trying to indicate before, it doesn't change just because you change your beliefs or your perceptual location. Okay, so it's not that you see a series of events and impose consciously a set of causal beliefs upon them. Rather, it's as though the world is simply giving you this information. If you're suitably open to the world, you have these perceptual experiences and they don't even seem like illusions. They seem to be features embedded in the world itself. Features that our experience somehow grasps directly. This is important because there's an especially important feature, the third important feature about these launching cases, which involves a distinction that it's important to keep in mind that I see people often failing to keep in mind. And that is the distinction between veridical illusions and falsifiable illusions. Now, if something is an illusion of X, that means your experience as of X is not due to X. So in a veridical illusion of X, you have an experience as of X, but your experience as of X is not due to X, making it an illusion, yet X obtains or is the case. So it's veridically illusory. And those of you familiar with David Lewis's account of veridical hallucination, we'll see the same kind of structure in that sort of case. In a falsifiable illusion of X, you also have an experience as of X. Your experience as of X is not due to X. Again, it's an illusion. But here, X does not obtain. So your experience is falsifiably illusory. Because the causal launching effect is sometimes correlated with causation, a juxtaposition of events that generates the launching effect can make a token launching effect a veridical illusion. You experience the juxtaposed events as causally related, but your experience of the sequence as causal is not due to the first event causing the second. It's just a matter of visual processing, even though in fact it is a causal sequence. But a different juxtaposition of events that generates a token launching effect can create a falsifiable illusion. You experience that sequence of events as causal, but in that case, it is not due to the first event causing the second. So Pong is a falsifiable illusion, okay? Everyone should see that it's a falsifiable illusion as of the ball getting hit by the little rackets there. But of course, even though there is a deeper causal structure that's embedded, what you seem to see, the ball getting hit back and forth, that's a falsifiable illusion, right? Everyone to be clear about that. Now, that's just so you can, I'm going to get to this in a minute, but I don't want people to be distracted by the Pong, so I'm just moving to the next slide. The problem, I think, can come out when we see that there are illusions that mix veridicality with falsificality. An illusion might be veridical in some respects, but falsifiable in others. An illusion as if A is F might be veridically illusory with respect to A's existence, but falsifically illusory with respect to A's actually being F. For example, as I've noted, a launching experience might be veridically illusory in that it might be an experience as of C causing E, even though the experience is not due to C causing E, yet in fact, C does cause E.
So in a billiard ball case, when you're seeing, when you're on a pool case, and you see the cue ball hit the eight ball, you have an experience as of the cue ball causing the eight ball to go into the corner pocket. Your experience of that sequence of events as causal is veridically illusory in the sense that it's an experience as of the cue ball causing the eight ball to go in the corner pocket. But the experience that you're having, right, is caused in part by visual processing, even though it's really true that the cue ball causes the eight ball to go into the corner pocket. That very same experience, and so here's the important part, right, might also, not only is it veridically illusory in the sense that you have this experience as of the cue ball hitting the eight ball into the corner pocket, right, where, and the cue ball really does hit the eight ball into the corner pocket, but you might experience it as doing so by transmitting a certain kind of productive oomph. But it might be that that transmission, that experience as of transmitting a productive oomph is a falsetical illusion. So for example, let's just take a different case for a minute, a pretend case, even more pretend. Take a launching experience that's veridically illusory in that it's an experience as of C causing E, even though the experience that you're having is not due to C's actually causing E, it's due to something else. Yet in fact, C causes E. The very same experience might also be falsetically illusory in that it's an experience as of C causing E by transmitting momentum. But in fact, while C does really cause E, it doesn't do so by transmitting momentum to E. C causes E by other means. So that would be then an example of an experience that has veridical, it's an illusion in the sense that it's a constructed experience. Parts of it, what it represents, is, or it veridically represents, and parts of it represent falsetically. Now the suggestion is this may be the central lesson of the launching case. For here we have the experience as of causal productivity. You have the experience when you see the red ball hit the eight ball as of causal productivity and launching, even when you believe or know that there's no causation involved in the relevant place. You know, you saw an image of a red ball and you saw an image of a blue ball. You did not see the red ball or the image of the red ball cause the image of the blue ball. You saw some motion on the screen. Does everybody understand what I'm saying there? So we impose, it's as though we're seeing the causation. Okay. Our sense of causal productiveness in the launching effect in particular is exposed then as being possibly a falsetical illusion. Now, I think the minimalist can then now use these types of results to argue that our experience of the world as being driven causally and temporally forward in a productive, oomphy way is then in general, right, naturally thought of as a merely constructed experience, one with veridical elements, but one also that might include falsetical elements. It's constructed in the sense that our visual processing of stimuli always involves constructing representations. But if this is right, then we can see how our experience can come apart from the features we should ascribe to the fundamental ontology of the external world. In particular, while we might grant that a causal and temporal direction obtain, the experiences as of features of productivity and oomphiness attached to our veridical experiences of these causal and temporal relations, the minimalist can argue, are merely falsetical illusions, byproducts of our causal processing, or our cognitive processing. Now, the last thing I want to mention about the importance of the Michaud launching cases is that these directly felt causal impressions of the launching variety are well understood to play an important role in the development of our understanding of causation from infancy. There's quite a bit of research about this. Developmental psychologists and cognitive scientists have done a lot of, I think, fascinating and important work on this point, showing how infants develop the ability to ascribe causation to the world and learn to manipulate causally by relying on modular perceptions involving launching to play a central role, among other sorts of perceptions, in developing our sense of the causal structure of the world as adults. So it's no surprise then if these kinds of causal lunching effects play an important cognitive role in the way that we learn about and understand the world as a kind of causal entity, and they're, you know, important in teaching us or giving us the mature ability to predict the way the world's going to unfold, there may be some innateness, innate abilities here as well. There's debate about that. Doesn't really matter for what I'm saying. The main thing to see is that there's no surprise then, if this is sort of embedded in our experience from early on and what we use to develop our understanding of the world, that the oomphiness or productive nature of causation seems natural, intuitive, and basic. Okay, now, I was mostly talking about causation, but I'd also like to talk about how we have this sense of being guided by the laws. And this, I think, is also very interesting. And there's some new work coming out of Josh Tenenbaum's lab where we talk about basically natural physical inferences we make. Okay, sort of physical, actually basically Newtonian intuitions that we have about the way the world works. This is sort of ordinary experience. And in this example of rock art, even though, we have the strong perceptual sense that the rock on the top is about to fall, okay? And you have the sense that, you know, it's supposed to kind of, you know, drop. But as a matter of fact, it very definitely is not going to fall. The rock is very stable. It's even withstanding rocks crashing into it. Now, as it turns out, in the U.S., apparently, there's this slightly new agey trend of rock balancing. And this is a bit of rock balancing or sculpture. It's not even glued. It's just balanced there. And it, you know, people will build these sculptures along the coast and have waves dramatically crashing against them and that sort of thing. But, you know, it could be glued. You'd still have the same kind of perceptual experience. So the point is that we experience what seems to be a feature of about to fallness to the rock, but that feature isn't there. Now, even knowing that, you're not going to, you know, eliminate or remove that experience you have of the rock as understanding that it has a potential trajectory of falling down. And the thought is, what Tenenbaum and Battaglia and Hamrick and others have discovered is that, look, what we've done as sort of inference machines is learn how the world sort of operates, you know, or evolves in a law-like way. And we impose that on the world when we try to make predictions and understand how the world's going to work. I mean, it's kind of obvious if you think about it. If you don't have a sense of how the world's supposed to evolve, you won't last very long. You'll step in front of the bus that's barreling down the road. But the thought is that you can isolate this sense we have of the world being productive and unfolding in a law-like way and separate it out from what's actually going on to identify the fact that we've given the world this kind of cognitive overlay. Okay, now, I'd like to finish up, although I have a finish up makes it seem like I'm almost done. I'm close to being done. By talking about how we perceptually construct a sense of direction from responses to external events. Now, we saw it with the Michaud case. We saw a causal direction as part of the illusion when we saw the illusion of what seemed to be the red ball causing the blue ball to move. But you also saw not just the motion direction, but you also saw another kind of illusion. You saw forwards causation. It seemed as though the motion of the red ball caused the motion of the blue ball, right? First it was the red ball moving, then it was the blue ball moving. What you didn't experience, so I bet, was thinking that it was the blue ball's later motion that caused the red ball's earlier motion. You didn't have an experience as of backwards causation. You had an experience as of forwards causation. That, of course, comes apart from the temporal direction, at least potentially. Now, there are other kinds of motion illusions that we can have and that are very easy to generate. One familiar case is if you've ever been on a train or a plane and looked out the window, waiting for your train to depart, you might suddenly get the sense that your train is moving, maybe pulling backwards out of the station by seeing, you know, the events outside the window. But then you might realize after a few more minutes, you get a few more perceptual cues that no, in fact, your train is not moving. There's a train next to you, and that train is moving forward. Okay. And what that arises from is the fact that, sort of phenomenologically, there's no difference between not moving and having something move this direction versus having something not moving and you moving back. Okay. So what's happening there? Well, what's happening is that, as it turns out, in the absence of kind of visual irregularities, your visual system prioritizes the background landscape as fixed. So unless we have additional information, when we have that kind of phenomenological identity, in other words, where we can't distinguish or indiscernibility, then the visual system will tell us that we're the ones that are moving. Very interestingly, that's how it works when we're driving, if anyone wants to talk about that. Turns out that driving, it just involves a lot of vertical illusion. It's very scary. Now being in a taxi is a whole new experience. Okay. The effect is so strong that it can dominate. There are well-known cases where you can take an individual and put them inside a cylinder that's got vertical lines on it, and you can be on a chair that you know is rigid and can't move. And then as you're sitting in there and the cylinder starts to spin, at first you'll know that, well, the walls are moving, but after a short while, your visual processing will take over and you'll feel like you're spinning and that the walls are not moving anymore. And that's, again, because the visual system prioritizes the background landscape as fixed and you as moving in the absence of any special visual cues to tell you, is it you that's moving or is it the background that's moving? And people will vomit because they feel like they're spinning so much. So the thought is here that we give examples then of how the visual system takes these bits of stimuli and constructs a sense of moving in a direction. It's very clearly a constructed sense of moving in a direction. Sometimes it's veridical, like when you're driving, right? Sometimes it's falsitical. But by focusing on the intensity and directness of these experiences, I mean to emphasize how, when we have them, they can dominate our phenomenology, such that it can seem as though we are simply directly and transparently latching onto features of our environment and then using them in our intuitions. In some cases, maybe that's the right thing to do. But as the empirical work in psychology shows, there are many properties of our experience that, even if they are veridical representations of features in the environment, and even if the character represented by these properties of our experience intrinsically matches the features they represent, they are still constructed. That is, they're often the result, at least partly, of a kind of pre-representational processing. We're not simply and directly and transparently latching on to the manifest image, or at least to features of our environment via the manifest image. Okay, so now that we have, I think, a sense of how experiences are constructed, given, I think, some of the best work in empirical psychology and vision science in particular that's out there, I think we can go back then to the dispute over explanation between the reductionist or the minimalist and the anti-reductionist. My point is that the minimalist can draw on the kinds of resources I've just outlined from cognitive science and use them to reject the demand that the anti-reductionist makes. She can reject the demand that we have to explain our ordinary intuitions involving directed production and oomphy causation by inserting a primitive, directed, productive property into fundamental reality. In other words, she can construct a principled, developed, empirically supportable alternative explanation of our experience of the external features of reality, and therefore challenge the inference to the best explanation of the anti-reductionist. So to do so, the minimalist then just simply argues that we take our experience of a set of events related by counterfactual dependence that exhibits certain patterns, including patterns given by the direction of entropic increase, and we impose an extra sense of a directed, causally guided productivity upon it. We have a sense of directed causal productivity from spatial-temporal juxtaposition and launching. We get lawful guidance from Bayesian learning, that was the rock tipping case. And perhaps we can even construct the direction of passage from visually processing external entropic asymmetries. Just like we visually privilege a fixed background to determine our direction of motion, we may privilege entropic increase to determine our direction of temporal passage. For example, take a series of three states with entropy values 1, 2, and 3, where the state with entropy 1, just n or whatever, but I'm just remembering, is temporally in between the states with, the state with entropy 2 is in between the states with entropy 1 and entropy 3. On this kind of picture, when the brain processes a batch of stimuli from these states, it takes a comparatively higher entropy state to define the default direction, and so represents a temporal direction by tracking changes of entropy in a direction of entropy increase. Imagine having a series of colors. So you could have three colored slides where an orange slide is in between a red slide on the left and a yellow slide on the right. Is the series of slides getting lighter or is it getting darker? Which direction do we go in? It depends what's taken as the default. Is a comparatively longer wavelength of light reflectance the default, or is a comparatively shorter one taken as the default? If the default is that a longer wavelength is what the visual system prioritizes, the series would be ordered visually in the getting darker direction. If the default were that it was shorter, the series would be taken to be ordered in the getting lighter direction. So the idea here is when the visual system may, or the cognitive system may just have a certain kind of default built into it. That's the way a lot of our representation works. And that might be the source of the temporal asymmetry that we experience. Okay, so I just want to finish up here. What time did we start? Did we start at
10:30?
Did we start at 10:30?
Yes.
I don't think so. About 10. Okay. Well, let me finish up. About 10 minutes late, I think. So on this story, right, the idea is that we might accept that while the temporal direction, which reduces to the direction, say, of entropy, is ontologically more fundamental than the causal direction, we might also say that our causal experience is in certain ways, important ways, epistemically more fundamental than our temporal experience, at least with regard to our sense of directed productivity and making things happen. So the thought is, we rely on experience of launching cases and other kinds of causal direction and causal productivity to then give us a sense of temporal direction, even while the metaphysics, the fundamental metaphysics, might be inverted. And the idea then is to go back to the dispute between the anti-reductionist and the minimalist and argue that the minimalist has now given us a developed explanation that relies only on a minimal ontology, but can provide an alternative explanation for our experience, and thus undercut the IBE that the anti-reductionist was attempting to do. Finished. Thank you.
Thank you very much.